So we've been talking about the conventionally appearing self as a convenient name for a particular causal series of body and mind experiences. No problem, just the way things are appearing. And we've been talking about the false self, the illusory self, as a kind of owner or controller or experiencer of this causal series. Some kind of solidification, reification of an ungraspable causal series into a graspable entity. And we in a kind of unconscious way, we maybe assume this is the case. We maybe don't consciously think this way, that we are that kind of entity, but we almost feel ourselves to be, at least sometimes, maybe if we're just walking in the woods and kind of feeling part of everything, we don't necessarily, we're not, I don't think we're always living in this false view of self, but it's ready for us to pick it up any time that we're insulted, for example, or offended, or praised, or disagree with another causal series. There are all these ways we know that it comes up instantly and effortlessly, the illusion of the false self. And we talked about some of the problems with feeling ourselves to be a kind of controller or experiencer. If we're a controller, that leads to the suffering of basically not being able to control things, feeling like I should be able to control my life and other people, but particularly my life, myself, and how frustrating that I can't. That's a frustration that comes with believing that we are a controller of the body and mind, or the owner of it. There's then any time it's being taken away by someone else or somehow it's our own death will take away this prized possession of this body and mind. It's my body and mind. Death, how could you take away what is mine? For example, via a suffering that comes from feeling that we're the owner of it. And just being an experiencer is just a limited way of being in the world compared to being just experience, ungraspable experience, and the flow of the vivid magnificence of life as just impermanent, arising as you see experience. I think it diminishes that magnificence of life to feel like I am just the experiencer of it. So another couple of problems with the false view of self that I don't think I brought up yet. Because I really want to make sure that this is our motivation for studying the self, to see all the discontent that arises from the false illusory self. For this false illusory self, there will always be some fear and aversion towards its own demise. If we feel that I am this separate entity of self, that obviously means that I, my true identity, who I really am, is going to die. It's kind of, maybe it feels like, well, isn't that so? But I think this is a very deeply held understanding that comes along with being a separate entity. We naturally, as soon as we're little kids, when we first hear about the reality of death and our own death, there's some sense of dis-ease with that. It's not just like a causal series of this particular body and mind will come to an end. That's okay, because there's lots of other causal series keep going. It's not okay, right? It's me we're talking about here. This particular body and mind is going to die, and therefore, if I am identified with that, I will always have some sense of fear of my own death, aversion to my own death, and before death, my own old age, sickness, and all kinds of other suffering. We might say, well, how could there be any alternative to this? But we're here in the sutra about like another version of self that doesn't die. So this fear, this almost like lurking unconscious fear of our own demise goes along with the identifying with ourselves as a kind of experiencer, owner of this body and mind. And the second issue here is that if for this separate self, there will always be at least some sense of lack, because there are things outside of ourself. For a limited separate self, we don't include everything. If we were to somehow include everything, there would never be a sense of lack possible. If I am everything, for example, right? But if I am just a separate entity, there'll always be something outside of myself, and therefore I lack something. Now, we might even feel like if we have everything in our life is going really well, materially, I have everything I ever wanted. There's nothing I can think of wanting more. My friends and family and spouse and like all those, you know, so-called others, I have them. We might feel like, so I don't really feel a sense of lack. But even then, in that kind of unrealistically ideal situation where we really have everything in the dualistic world that we want, even then, I think there's still some sense of lack. Like, there's some sense of outside. There's something outside myself. Other beings are outside myself. There's some discontent that comes with I don't include everything. And we often, you know, feel this sense of, if only I just had this one thing that I don't have, right? I, the separate individual entity of self, I don't have that perfect job, that perfect partner, that perfect bank account, like perfect house, perfect car. I lack them there outside myself. But again, without having to kind of own everything, if we have this larger, more inclusive sense of self, it could be possible that if there's nothing outside of itself, the self, by its very nature, lacks nothing. So this is worth considering. The separate self is always subject to fear and lack, which are forms of discontent, suffering. So that's just a little bit more of the bad news of the separate self. and why it's such a problem, right? Talking about it's the root of all discontent. There's so many ways to look at this issue, and I think it's good to be familiar with them. Self. It's good to keep exploring these different aspects and how different people talk about it. So, in Webster's dictionary, you look up the word self, and there's various definitions. It's a complex thing, but I thought this one was the clearest to me. Just the regular dictionary definition of self. We haven't really talked about the third type of true self yet, but see if, as you hear this definition, see if you can locate Webster's definition of self in one of these types of self. So here's the definition. Well, one definition just says the entire person of an individual. That was a little bit vague to me. But hear this one. The self is the union of elements as body, emotions, thoughts, and sensations that constitute the individuality and identity of a person. I think so. I think it's a good English dictionary definition of the conventional self, the causal series. Here it is again. The self is the union of elements, body and mind elements, and it has in parentheses as body, emotions, thoughts, and sensations, like we've been talking about, end of parentheses, that constitute the individuality and identity of a person. We might say that conventionally constitute their identity. You know, we could say our true identity is not just this union of elements, but conventionally that's the identity that makes up the individuality of a person conventionally. And we have different body, emotions, thoughts, and sensations, so that we have different individualities conventionally. No problem with this. It doesn't, of course, Webster's doesn't bring out all the flaws of the separate self. I think it's a particularly kind of Buddhist issue or understanding. So I thought that was pretty good definition of the conventional self. Webster doesn't talk about either of the other two. It doesn't talk about the false illusory self or the true self. Because dictionaries are kind of conventional. So another thought that I had was that this causal series, the individual self of our particular causal series that is then grasped as an entity, it's a collection of habitual patterns. And sometimes we talk about the fourth skanda as almost could translate it as habitual patterns. And it's, each of us have our own habitual patterns. They're part of our own causal series. Habitual patterns are particularly habitual ways of relating to people and things. I think, isn't it interesting how we all have our unique way of relating to each other and to things? And we know that about each other. It's part of our personality. And in fact, therefore, when we relate to each other, we might relate slightly differently because, oh, that person relates a little bit more like this, so we try to adapt to them, right? Which is actually, that's kind of nice, I think, that we can adapt our way of relating a little bit to others. It means that we're not so fixated on our particular habitual way of relating. But we have a familiar way of relating to people and things that feels like me. Like I see somebody else relating to the image that just came to mind is like there was a homeless fellow who was here a few weeks ago, occasionally visits the Zen Center, and he's kind of a crazy wisdom character. He's kind of mischievous, but in a good-hearted way, not angry or destructive. But he I was out here with Patrick was around too this day. He you know, we have the Jizo Bodhisattva with his staff, his staff with the three rings, the six rings on it. And this fellow like picked out that staff and started kind of waving it around as a magic wand. I think that was maybe kind of, maybe his sort of habitual way of relating to things. It was very playful. It wasn't aggressive or destructive. It was playful. But my habitual way of relating to things is different. So I'm like, it really disturbed me, right? I'm like, this is like Jizo Bodhisattva here, and it, you know, it's his staff. You were there too, I think. Yes, yes, yeah, I think so. Yeah, he was my teacher. Yeah, he pointed out this habitual way that I have of relating, and he has of relating, and I tried to be a little bit playful with him and meet him. And he said, but the Bodhisattva is not in that stone thing there. That was good teaching for me. But I said, yeah, but also we try to really respect the stone things too. And he said, oh, I know, I understand. And so he put the staff back. What? Yeah, exactly. He adapted his pattern a little bit to me, and I adapted a little to him. But still, we have these familiar ways of relating to people and things. And at first, I was like, I like went into my familiar thing of like, I'm responsible for the temple property and the taking care of the bodhisattvas. So these habitual ways and familiar ways of relating, my thought was that this familiarity may be another way of looking at the illusion of the separate self. The familiarity could be just the part of the causal patterns. We each have our unique habitual ways of relating, but the familiarity is like it's so similar. It's part of what makes us feel like the same person. Like, of course, I respond this way immediately and habitually, and that familiarity and the comfort in the familiarity is, I think, what helps create the sense of separate self. So, which is why if there's some affront to our comfortable familiarity, we feel some resistance and tension about that. We feel like it's kind of threatening my very self, my sense of my comfortable, familiar way of being. So that the comfort of familiarity may be what helps to solidify and maintain the illusion of a separate self. So this is not in the traditional teachings, it's just reflecting, trying to understand myself. Something's very familiar, and generally familiar is comfortable. Even like like our own kitchen or something, right? We come in, it's like, this is a comfortable place because it's so familiar, and I have it set up the way that I set it up, and it's almost like an extension of ourself. Our familiar surroundings. That's why it's kind of nice for the illusory separate self to kind of travel and be in unfamiliar places. It kind of like shakes up our identity a little bit. Exactly. There's good reasons for habitual. There's good reasons for familiar. Yeah. If every time we walk in the kitchen, we like, well, where is everything? I have no idea. It's like I've never been here before. Yeah. Like, that wouldn't be so efficient. So the memory creates, I decided to put that there so I'd remember where it is, and then it becomes almost like part of our identity. It doesn't have to, and I think there's some gray area where between the conventional self and the false illusory self. They're kind of intertwined, right? And where does the causal series start to slip over into where it really starting to hold something unnecessarily? It's not so clear-cut. Although it's nice, I think, to look at, to tease apart the definitions like this. So these days where science is very prominent and scientific research is working its way into Buddhist studies and meditators, so it's nice to occasionally bring up perspectives here. So one thing I learned about is that, like, from a kind of neuroscience point of view, we might wonder, what about the self in relation to, say, neuroscience and the brain? I think I even had the question, you know, we have all these different parts of the brain that now they can find our, like, locations for the different senses, right, are all different locations in the brain. But what about the sense of self, the sense of the separate individual self? That question came up for me a while ago of, like, is that located in a certain part of the brain? And I came to understand the latest model for this, the latest understanding, I think, is called the default mode network. Has anybody heard of this? Mm-hmm. The DMN, default mode network. You can look it up on Wikipedia. I think that's as far as I got. It's, you know, so much on this kind of thing. That has a nice description. The default mode network is this large-scale brain network. Which creates the sense of the self. I think maybe both the conventional causal series type of self, or last week we talked about how the subjectivity, the sense of subjectivity, might be slightly different than the sense of reifying the subject as a separate self. So I think subjectivity comes from this default mode network. But what's quite interesting, I think, is that it's kind of nice in a way, is that the sense of self is not some particular location in the brain that you could remove or poke at or something. It's a network. Whereas the other senses and all are particular points, the sense of self is so complex that it can't be located some certain place. It's a relationship of a bunch of different areas of the brain working together. That's why it's called a network. And I think it's called default mode because it's the kind of, like, it's the standard way of seeing our sense of individuality or self. And I think this is just Wikipedia descriptions, but so default mode network is the neurological basis for the self, including autobiographical information, which is like memories of collection of events and facts about ourselves. So this network helps create that autobiographical story. It helps create this self-referencing, referring to traits and descriptions of ourself, and it creates the emotion of self, which is like reflecting about one's own individual emotional state. And it is responsible for remembering or recalling past events of me, and it's responsible for imagining future events for me, and understanding and comprehending narratives and stories about ourselves. Something like this. And apparently the default mode network is maybe sort of like when we're just not so involved in anything, we're just definitely in states of like daydreaming. The default mode network is highly active, and but supposedly when we're very concentrated on a particular task, focused on a particular task, the default network kind of isn't operating so much. All those connections aren't being made because we're zoomed in on one thing, which is why if you're really concentrated, I know as an artist, when I'd be really involved in a detailed painting, Ziggy probably knows this as an artist. The zone, yeah. I could go for hours, and I'd come out, and like the sun was setting or something. Like it was kind of like a timeless realm. My sense of you know, being hungry or getting cold, I didn't notice because I was so focused. And then I come out of the painting, and I'm like, oh, actually, it's getting cold, and I'm hungry, and I'm kind of back into my narrative. I got to go take care of myself now. So that might be a kind of extreme example of getting really involved in. And they also study, I think they maybe have studied various operations of default mode network, but the ones that I think appeared in Wikipedia are like psychedelic substances that people under that influence, it deactivates the default mode network, in that sense of separate self. Because they can do brain scans at this time, right, which they're doing these days. And long-term meditators in meditative absorption deactivates the default mode network, which is, I think, in quite a different way than being very focused on a particular point, although maybe that would do it too. If you're really on the breath, for example, your sense of narrative isn't really operating. But also maybe in emptiness meditations, we're not focused on our story so much in meditation. So, this is a little neuroscience. Yes?
I think it would be really awesome to pursue this maybe as a conversation, but there was an issue earlier this year, the Buddha Dharma, and it was talking about the slow path, fast path, and where psychedelics intersect with meditation because of that description. They're shutting down, they call it the default neural network, but shutting that down and people having no sense of ego, but even having what they call a death experience, and they come back, you know, with a complete paradigm shift, and they continue to integrate it with their practices. But I just got a book called Zigzag Zen, and I saw that it's in the library, and it has that whole conversation, and it going back to Esalen's founding.
Yeah. I actually have a chapter in that book.
Oh, you do?
So I know. But it's a complicated conversation, right? It's a complex conversation, and of course, traditional Buddhism, it can come at this without that. But it's exploration that's growing in this country and this modern world with the interface between these two. And just to say, the part of the danger is that there's some people that these things would really not be helpful for, right? So if it starts to become a larger conversation, it has that problem, right? Yes.
Asking this question of myself, who is the self that dreams? It feels like such an important part of the experience of this life. So much of what we spend in sleep and dream, who is that? And how are we, what are we availing ourselves of? I mean, there are so many traditions.
You're talking about like sleeping dream,
yes,
right? Yeah,
dream,
yeah.
As sensations, perceptions,
well, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's a mysterious thing.
It is, and it's a great area to explore. And I think that generally it's like our conventional sense of self is operating in dreams. And not only our habitual patterns, like we don't feel like we're a different person in a dream, right? Some of it is we might respond a little differently to things in dreams, but I think there's a great familiarity in dreams. We generally operate in very similar ways as waking life, responding to people who are scared of the similar things. But it's a great area to explore also as we get more into this third type of true self, because dreams are very interesting because they create an objective world with all our senses shut off, right? And maybe the default mode network That's an interesting question that somebody might have studied. Is that helping create the dream world? Or is it a whole different thing that's creating the dream world? But in the dream world, there's subject-object duality. I think that's what's really interesting. There's an objective world, and we almost always dream from the point of view of a subject, looking out through eyes. We often don't look down at our body, but we have a sense of location, subjective location in the dream, right? Relating to an objective world. But we feel, in the dream, we feel like we're located behind the eyes. But of course, that's not the case in a dream. There's no seeing happening in a dream. But I think that's so interesting to me to reflect on that, because it's like the sense of self gets created behind the eyes, because like all our sense organs are around here, so we start feeling like I reside behind the eyes and ears. But that's an illusion, I would say, created by the location of the sense organs. But that illusion is so deep, because we live all day as if we exist behind the eyes, that when we dream and we're not behind the eyes, there are no eyes in a dream. We're not seeing in a dream. It's a complete projection, right? It's a complete imagination. But the sense of being behind the eyes is still there in the dream. And the external world, the dualistic perception, the illusion of dualistic perception is in a dream. And one nice thing about reflecting about that is that it's proof for all of us that you can have a completely convincing dualistic perception of subject and object that really, really does not exist whatsoever. It's completely mind constructed, right? So, and in fact, people like Vasubandhu discovered that a long time ago and uses this dream, explores this idea of dreaming as part of his kind of proof for kind of like mind-only teachings. Of like, here's an example, an ordinary example that it can be like this. Yeah.
And then just the idea that, you know, in Buddhism there's six senses, not just five senses.
Yeah.
And that sixth sense, you know, there's that image of the house, you know, where, you know, the five doors. And then there's the basement door, and the five doors are the, you know, the conventional senses, and that basement door is what Uchiyama called, you know, mind secretions. Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, thoughts and memories that are coming up, like even right now, in our minds. And when we're sleeping, when we're not in such deep sleep, those mind secretions come up. And just like I would react to a thought about, I always say, car repair, and I also would react to that thought with another story. And so that's also kind of a theory of what dreaming is. It's just these mind secretions, and then the mind reacted to those secretions.
In the way that it...
So you get this, you develop this story that you're acting out in your sleep.
And it helps process, like, unprocessed events from the day.
If those are kind of churning in you, of course they'll continue to churn.
Yeah, or sometimes we maybe resolve something in a dream that we didn't resolve when we're awake. And you know, Tibetan Buddhism has this dream yoga practice, which is, I think, a fairly challenging practice. But the idea being that if you can train your meditation practice so deeply and your intention so deeply in waking life, you can then, in the dream, instead of being just carried around by habitual patterns, you can actually practice in your dream. So you can actually sit down on a cushion and do the meditation, and the same kind of meditation that you do in waking life, in a dream, and you have extra meditation time while you're asleep. I know, it's amazing. It's a lot of hours. Yeah, yeah.
Bathroom breaks.
Yeah, no bathroom breaks. That's right. Yeah, so much potential.
Lucid dreaming is different than that, right? Well, lucid dreaming, there's a whole practice of it where you enter and take control.
Well, that's what this would be an example of that. This would be like lucid dreaming. Is you know that you're dreaming, and that I'm going to keep dreaming, but I actually am present enough that I'm going to do. I set out to do some zazen in my dream, so now I'm going to. I think you can only do that kind of thing when you're lucidly dreaming. I think this practicing in the dream is involving lucid dreaming. Lucid just means you know that you're dreaming, but you're not waking up.
Yes, but let's say you aren't going to practice often.
Okay.
You could do something else. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could do anything.
You could do anything.
If you were lucid.
But is this like causal, still causal self? Initiating a different kind of response to this?
I think so. And I would put it in the category still of this, of the conventional self in this unusual mode of dreaming. And it's still playing out its patterns, right? So if we're not so deeply trained, then we just act on our usual desires in the dream, or it's just habitual pattern instead of intention running the dream. But if we train our intentions so deeply, we may be able to then choose what to do in the dream.
Yeah, a different kind of response.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and one could, for example, meditate on these three types of self in a dream and say, this is the dreaming conventional self. Am I going to fixate on this? Which is usually in the dream, I would say, not only is it the causal series, usually it's the false illusory self in the dream too. If we're ever scared in a dream, that's what that is. We feel like we're the subject that's being threatened in the dream, even though there's actually nothing to be afraid of in the dream because it's a dream. But the false self is activated because that's our usual pattern. But if we were working with these, we could, like the tiger could be chasing us in the dream, and if we were lucid, we could be like, wait a second, this is not me. Like, I'm much bigger than this, which actually I am in the dream, right? I am the tiger. That's another thing the dream points out. I am the tiger and the person running from the tiger, right? It's literally true in the dream, which is another nice way that the metaphor points to, like, kind of like, it's a way to help access this, the big self, true self, where I am the tiger and the person running. So, yeah, yes.
I think in my limited experience of lucid dreaming, the way I experience it is to recognize that this is one story. Story.
Yeah.
And if you try to control, if you try to act, be an experiencer of a dream and control the situation, you wake up.
Mm-hmm.
It's lost. So there's a really subtle distinction there in my experience with lucid dreaming. I'm trying to be a controller.
Yes.
It's just a story.
That's a great point.
And
yeah.
I think that that's a great metaphor for talking about self too.
Yep, that's my very limited experience with lucid dreaming too, is that, if you get too coarse about it, okay, I'm lucid dreaming now, let's get to work, and it's like, you just wake up. It's like, it's a little bit like zazen. If you get too coarse about how you're directing the mind, you kind of come out of the zone. Yes.
Someone trained him in lucid dreaming, and the first thing they trained him is to be able to recognize whether you're dreaming or awake.
Yes.
Because those states are not very different.
Yes.
The main difference, apparently, between actual awake state and dreaming is that when you're dreaming, the objects that you observe can change very randomly,
mm-hmm.
whereas they don't tend to do that so much
yep.
in the actual waking
mm-hmm.
state. And then the other thing that he basically learned to do was just to look. He was always being shocked by someone in the street, and so he was always in terror of this person coming in the door and shooting him. And so he learned to just kind of look down at his body and see that, you know, things, bullets and stuff were going in, but there was no bleeding.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, and that no matter what this scary kind of person did to him, it actually didn't have any effect because it was just a dream. And then he stopped having that thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Power of the mind. Amazing.
I heard that same story.
Did you? Yeah.
And after the shooting, and there was no blood, then the assailant started laughing.
Wow. Because they say all the characters in the dream are ourself,
right.
And different parts of ourself. So yeah, the one that was kind of the self-sabotage one is like, oh, you finally got the joke. Yeah. Great. Back to India. Ancient India, we have this term Atman, that generally means like the self or like a spirit. Sometimes people would translate it as soul or the essence or breath. And as many Indo-European words have the same roots, in German, Atmen means to breathe. So I think this really is the same root, Atman and Atman. And apparently that's one of the nuances of Atman, is like the essential breath that is like ourself. This is one way of looking at it, but I just think that's an interesting German root there. I think probably India first. The earliest use of Atman is in the Rig Veda, which is, you know, way before Buddha's time. I forget if it's like even 2,000, 5,000 BC or something. These Vedas go way, way back in India. And but people were, it's when humans maybe first trying to understand, what is this? What is going on here? Who are we? So this, in the Rig Veda, the Atman means that some kind of pervading principle or ultimate sentient principle of a sentient being. So over the centuries, the idea of Atman changed and evolved, and still, like in India, it's like there's many different contradictory understandings of Atman, which is what the sutra is largely about. Sutra grew up in this milieu of lots of different Indian philosophies talking about the Atman and the Buddha's teaching of Anatman. So we could keep going with all these interesting related tales of self and so on, but let's make the transition from these two types of conventional self and false self to the true self, as the sutra makes the transition very beautifully with this parable. And it's too long to read the whole parable, so it goes on for pages. So this is like the summary version. It's not on this handout because it's too long. I couldn't figure out how to summarize it. So I'll just tell you the story. But I love this story. It's in chapter 3. Yeah. So, which we have a bunch of other parts of chapter 3 here, but it's, In the Mark Bloom translation, it's pages 63 to 69. So, once upon a time, there was a, in old India, there was a kingdom and a Raja, a king lived there, and he had his like, royal doctor that was also the, like that kind of, doctor of the whole, maybe it was a kind of smaller town, doctor of the whole town, or at least like the head doctor of the town or something. And, but this doctor was just like not so skillful. It's the best one that the king could find, but he was, we might call it quack doctor. It's like they're not so. They can help somewhat, but they like have a lot of weird old folk remedies that maybe aren't so good. So a doctor's not so skillful, and sometimes he prescribes the right medicine, and sometimes he doesn't. That helps people, but for the most part, like most of what he prescribes isn't so helpful. but it's the best the king could find, right? So, and of course, the quack doctor likes to be that doctor. He's getting paid very well by the king. But one day, a skillful doctor comes to town. Part of the story too. I'll try to weave in what the parable is pointing to as I tell the parable. This quack doctor. Oh, part of why he's kind of not so skillful is he doesn't have a big toolkit. He always prescribes the same medicine for everyone, and it's milk medicine. It's like this, you know, which is part of Ayurvedic healing in India. But it's like some, I don't know whether it's just milk itself or it's milk-based medicine. But and just incidentally, in this Parinirvana Sutra, all throughout these 1,000 pages, we'll see that milk is this common metaphor used in all these different ways for Buddha nature, actually, and the true self. So here, milk is the teaching of self. He always prescribes for everybody's suffering the teaching of self. And this is similar to some schools in Indian spirituality, even today. They're like, you just have to realize your true self. And then everything is clear. But there's lots of different philosophies of what the self is, and I think particular, if we're talking about the philosophies, it's whenever the self is subtly made into an experiencer, either a doer or an experiencer, even if it's like, well, it's an all-encompassing, ever-blissful self, but that's the experiencer of everything, or it's what really does everything in our life. As soon as you add in the doer or the experiencer, it starts to solidify it. That's one problem with some views of Atman. And I think Sutra doesn't say it specifically, but that's how I think of this unskillful doctor. Is he always teaches this true self, but he teaches it a little bit off track, like some kind of experiencer or doer. And he prescribes that medicine for all ailments. And once in a while, somebody is cured by it. They actually like understand it correctly. They overlook the fact that it's an experiencer, and they just get the balance aspect of it or something, and they're cured. But the skillful doctor comes to town, and of course this is going to be the Buddha, right? And sees that like that doctor is like he hasn't studied medicine so much. He just has this one thing that he just is like the cure-all. And I think it would help people to like diagnose them more particularly and prescribe like different medicines for different sicknesses. But I can't get in there to talk to the king because he's like the royal doctor. So I think he even asks the quack doctor, like, Can I actually come in and talk to the king a little bit? And he's like, what are you talking about? It's my turf. I got a good salary here and I'm the royal doctor, so, you know, maybe he even had some sense of, he's probably a better doctor, but I better keep him away. So the skillful doctor, out of skillful means to kind of help the king and the kingdom, says to the quack doctor, well, can I just like be your apprentice then? He's very humbly, and he's like, really means it. I'd like to just work with you. And skillful doctor, I mean, the quack doctor is kind of like, okay, you can just like, I know you're a doctor and all, but like, really, how about you just take out the trash for a few years? And he's like, okay, I'll do it for minimum wage. And so the skillful doctor's hired, and he becomes friends with the unskillful doctor, and Sometimes he's even taking out the trash in the king's palace. And one time the king has some problem, and he happens to be there alone with the king, and kind of offers some other kind of medicine, maybe, or a recommendation. And the king feels like, wow, actually, that's really good. And so the king kind of discovers that this Buddha doctor is more skillful, so he actually does fire the quack doctor. So poor guy. and makes this new skillful doctor the royal doctor of the village. And the first thing the new doctor does is ban milk medicine. It's like, this is not working. It's not, for most people, it's actually not good. And we have all these other medicines, and there's all these kind of sicknesses. In fact, we have 84,000 types of medicine. And the Buddha, of course, really does have all these different teachings. There's so many sutras. He doesn't even always just teach not self, right? He teaches so many things to different people. So this is kind of skillful means of this doctor. Many medicines for many ailments, and he diagnoses accurately, and people start getting much more healthy and better, and nobody's taking that Atman milk medicine anymore. They're taking Anatman medicine mostly. The teachings that this body, these feelings, these perceptions, these karmic formations, this dualistic consciousness, these are not yourself. Wow, that really frees me from a lot of existential grasping and suffering. See, this teaching of Anatman, these are not self. Let's not even talk about a self. That medicine's banned. Right? So people get healthy. Then one day the king himself is sick, and the skillful doctor makes a skillful diagnosis and says, actually, for your case today, I think the best thing for you would be milk medicine. Mm-hmm. And the king is immediately like, are you crazy? Are you totally insane? That stuff is totally toxic. And like, nobody, you banned it yourself. What are you talking about? Milk medicine. And the skillful doctor's like, this particular ailment, you've been taking the non-milk medicine for a long time, the Anatman teachings. You've really understood them, integrated them, and been cured from a lot of suffering by these Anatman medicines. And now, I think for you, it would be good to take the Atman medicine. Milk medicine. So the king totally resists because he's been kind of trained to not take it. So it takes, the sutra goes on for a while, like kind of the doctor kind of arguing with the king and trying to convince him to take the milk medicine. But he trusts this doctor. So he finally agrees and he takes the milk medicine and he's completely cured. Amazing. Totally amazing. It's the teaching of true self here, but taught in an accurate way, and taught only long after the king was totally understood Anatman. That's why it's nice. We spent like 2.5 weeks talking about what's not the true self. We talked about the conventional self and the problems of the false self. The false self is, you really got to see what the false illusory self is and why it's the problem. And I really get steeped in how all these conditioned, conventional phenomena are not self. As it says in chapter 2 here, meditate on all that's constructed and compounded. All these phenomena are not self, anatman, and they're not eternal. So Buddha teaches that, and then if one's really steeped in that, then one can maybe take the true self teaching and understand it correctly. And not be harmed by it. So the king is cured, and then after that he issued a new decree in the kingdom that everyone's allowed to take milk medicine again now, as long as it's prescribed by the doctor for your particular illness. And of course, the people did the same thing. They all were like, what? What are you talking about? That's toxic. It's no good. It was banned. So again, it takes the whole village a while to get on board with this new teaching of Atman. Because the whole village of Buddhists were trained so long in Anatman. So I think it's a beautiful metaphor for a parable, really, for what this sutra is doing. The sutra is very conscious of the fact that Anatman is like the central teaching of Buddha. There was no Atman teaching of Buddha before the sutra. The sutra appeared in like 200 to 300 of the Common Era, so like many centuries after the Buddha's time. All the Buddhist teachings were circulating all through India at this time. Anatman was like the apex of their teaching in a way. And so this sutra is like, we have something new to say here, but we know this is going to be controversial. So that's why I think this parable shows how controversial it is, and yet how if a skillful doctor prescribes this Atman teaching for those who are tamed and disillusioned by the false self, identifying with the causal series as their true identity. If they're already like steeped in that, then we can hear this new teaching. So, could you follow the parable of the milk medicine? So, so let's turn to the sutra of chapter 3 here. They all have these titles of different characters and the stories about different people. On grief, I think here means, I can't remember why it's even called that, this long chapter. I think it's maybe the Buddha's passing from this world, right? It's parinirvana, so people all around him are grieving. That might be why it's called that. And, so this chapter has the four inverted views, the teaching of the true self, and the parable of the milk medicine. So this is also in chapter 3 here, just another little incidental note that I think is interesting, that the Buddha is talking with the Sangha, and Mahakashapa is there. Mahakashapa is one of Buddha's senior disciples. But in the early teachings before the sutra, Mahakashapa was just one of the senior disciples. But in this sutra, the Buddha says, I now leave the unsurpassed Dharma in the hands of Mahakashapa. You may now rely upon him. He will be your refuge. So this might be the first time that the sutra kind of puts Mahakashapa as kind of like the main successor of the Buddha, which of course is the Zen story. Zen story, we have this lineage, and Mahakashapa is the one who, when the Buddha holds up the flower, smiles, and that becomes this, the lineage in Zen is so important. And although Mahakashapa was an important character in the Pali Suttas, you never hear statements quite like this, like he's going to, the Buddha in the early sutras says, nobody's going to be in charge of the Sangha. You'd all be a light unto yourselves. But in this sutra, this Mahakashapa thing might be the origin of the Zen lineage story. So this chapter says, to think, Buddha's now teaching this, to think of discontent or suffering, dukkha, as bliss, sukha, and to think of bliss as discontent. These are like opposite terms, right? This is distorted dharma. To think of the impermanent, the anicca, as the eternal, or the permanent, nitya, and to think of the eternal as the impermanent is distorted dharma. To think of what is not self, anatman, as the self, the Atman, and to think of the self as not self is distorted dharma. to think of the impure ashubha as the pure shubha, and to think of the pure as the impure is distorted dharma. So this is in the early teachings before the sutra, these four points. I think we maybe talked about in previous weeks these kind of characteristics of compounded phenomena. All constructed or conditioned phenomena are not ultimately satisfying. They're dukkha. They're suffering. But I'd like to say it as all conditioned things are not ultimately satisfying. They're not permanent. They're all impermanent. They're not self. They're not who we truly are. And they're not pure. They're tainted by dualistic fixation. That teaching you find in the early teachings. And incidentally, I just found recently, in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, and I think there's some debate about when Patanjali lived, but it was definitely after the Buddha's time. But for yoga practitioners, this is a super important, popular text, like a Mount Madonna. This is almost like their Bible, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. It's probably around 100 to 300 CE, so around the time of this sutra, Patanjali lived, but so long after the Buddha. And this sutra, write it down here, basically says the same thing. It has this verse, those of you who know the sutra, in chapter 2, verse 5, in the Yoga Sutras, it's almost an exact quote from the Buddha's teachings about these four points. And I think it says, almost like this sutra says, to think of the discontent as bliss is distortion. To think of impermanent as permanent is distortion. To think of as not self as self is a distortion. And to think of the pure as the impure as the pure is a distortion. It's almost like a quote from a Buddha sutra. These four points are so a kind of characteristic of Buddha. I thought it's so interesting. And even Patanjali is making a case for anatman in that verse. So he just, and that verse just goes that direction. Like the Buddha's early teachings, they just say, to think of impermanent phenomena as permanent, this is a distortion and it's going to lead to suffering. So, but what I mean by that direction is, the verse from the sutra that I just read goes both directions, right? It says, to think of discontent as bliss is distortion, but also to think of bliss as discontent is distortion. That's a new thing for this sutra. It's saying that, I think what it's implying here is, there really is, as we'll see later, the true self of, which is eternal, blissful, true self, and pure. To see that one as impermanent, impure, not self, and impermanent is, that's a distortion. Can you follow that? To think of, in other words, to think of all these conditioned, impermanent things as permanent and unconditioned, that's mainly what the Buddha's saying. Don't do that in the early teachings. That's like where, to think of what you think of as the self, it's really not self. So don't see this not self as some sort of true self. That's the early teachings. He's reiterating that. That's true. But also the other way. Don't think of what is true self as not self. Don't think of what is truly eternal as impermanent. So it's, so these are called the four inversions. And it's really, you could say it's eight inversions. Eight inverted views. Inverted means like distorted or upside down views. Can you follow that? So this is going to get played out more and more through the sutra. as one of its big points. So it's good to clarify this here, is that the Buddha's early teachings are really emphasizing conditioned phenomena and the problems with conditioned phenomena, which is the five aggregates.
So this characteristics of compounded self, that's the early teaching?
Yes.
Okay.
Characteristics. You mean in chapter 2 there? On our handout here in chapter 2, this section I put in was really coming from the early teachings, but it's in the sutra. Buddha says, now meditate on all that's constructed, all that's compounded, all that's conditioned. The word is samskritta. Contemplate how all things, all phenomena, which are constructed, conditioned, how they're not self and they're not eternal and that nothing endures, the sutra says. So this is, we've been talking about this the last couple of weeks too, but it's good to keep remembering. This is like Buddhism 101. This is like really important that we get this, these alternatives to milk medicine really clear before we drink the milk medicine. And this great medicine from the early teachings, all conditioned phenomena, means anything that arises and ceases dependent on conditions, which is everything that we can possibly experience. Everything is conditioned. Every phenomena, five aggregates of body, feelings, perceptions, karmic patterns, dualistic consciousness, these all arise and cease. They're conditioned. Therefore, they have four qualities. These four kind of marks of all phenomena, of all conditioned phenomena, besides being conditioned. They're impermanent. That makes sense, right? If something's conditioned, then it arises and ceases, dependent on conditions. It's impermanent. It's not self. And here it means it's not some true, eternal self. None of these, especially the five aggregates, this body and mind are not myself, not my true, enduring self. That kind of, they're not an Atman, because they're all conditioned, right? Make sense? They're not ultimately satisfying, because even the best experiences are impermanent, and they're not going to last. Therefore, they're not like eternally blissful. Right? There's problems with every conditioned experience. That's what the Buddha means by dukkha. And the fourth is they're not pure, and I think in this case, pure means free of dualistic fixation. Impure means everything's tainted by our dualistic grasping. Does that make sense? That everything that's conditioned has these four qualities of impermanence, unsatisfying, not self, and impure. That's like standard early Buddhism. And Buddha's saying, if we think that the impermanent is permanent, that's a distortion, right? That's a false view. If we think that the not-self is truly a... what is not-self is actually a self, that's a distortion. If we think that what's impermanent is permanent, that's an inverted view. If we think that what is impure is pure, that's an inverted view. That's our problem, is that we do think in these inverted ways. Follow that part?
Mm-hmm.
So then now the Buddha here brings up the opposite, too, for the first time, is saying, he's kind of hinting at that now that we're talking about a realm that's not a conditioned phenomena. And even in the early teachings, I think last week Rick brought up this point of, like, the Buddha says famously in the Pali Canon, nirvana is an unborn, undying, unconstructed, unmade, unchanging freedom. That's a kind of definition of nirvana. So there is that teaching, but he didn't call that true self. But now we're kind of building on that teaching and saying, nirvana is unconditioned. It's not a conditioned phenomenon. And maybe this is part of why this is called the Nirvana Sutra. It's kind of building on that one verse, really, in the Pali teachings. But here we're saying it's also a distortion then to think that that which is unchanging, like unchanging nirvana, to think that nirvana changes, that's a distortion. To think that nirvana is impermanent. To think that the purity of nirvana is actually impure, that's a distorted view. To think that the bliss of nirvana, which the Buddha talked about that in the early teachings, if bliss sounds too extreme, we could just say the total contentment, unwavering contentment of nirvana, to think that that's lacking something or is actually discontent, that's a distortion. And then particularly the most radical thing is here to say, to think that what is truly the self, what is truly the Atman, to think that that's just another not-self thing, that's a distortion. There really is a true self. And that's kind of for the first time said in this sutra, there is an Atman. So this verse, if you take this home, you can read it over and over and just see how Buddha's doing this new twist here. It's not just to think of discontent as bliss, but to think of bliss as discontent. Both of those are distorted dharma.
So isn't that sort of like refuting sort of the nihilistic tendency of the
Atman? That would be one way to look at it. Yeah, is that... Yeah, that's one twist on it. There's many twists that the sutra will keep getting into, but that would be one reason why the Buddha starting to offer the self teaching again. Maybe even in the milk medicine parable. Maybe since everyone was so into anatman, there's like, well, there is no true self, and that's all we know and we're taught. And maybe it's a little nihilistic, and the Buddha's willing to now bring in this positive side of things. It really is a kind of a positive thing to say, this reality of Buddha is eternal and is pure and is blissful and is a true self. It's definitely would be, from an early Buddhist point of view, that kind of statement is almost like heretical. It is really kind of heretical. So that's why this sutra is, I think, consciously being quite radical. Although, we don't really find any contradiction. I don't find any contradiction to the early teachings. Because he's not saying there's some real entity called a self. That's why it's so important to clarify these different types of self. The self is another name for emptiness. Or the self is unconditioned. That's, I think, the key point. If there's any conditioned thing called a self, that's not the Dharma. So we're going to keep exploring what this true self is. It's really the kind of main point of this whole sutra.
You spoke about the eternal aspect of the Buddha and the Buddha's
teaching. Yeah. So, and that will keep getting played out through this sutra too. These teachings?
What?
These teachings, you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, this notion that the Buddha is eternal, mm-hmm. Buddha's teachings are eternal.
Mm-hmm.
But are they eternal if it all goes away? Living the earth is destroyed.
Well, yeah, that's a big question that we could discuss. I mean, in Zen, we have this koan that I think beautifully points to that, of somebody asks a teacher, when the whole universe is destroyed at the end of the kalpa, which is a Buddhist view, is that this universe, not just the earth, the whole universe is going to be destroyed at the end of this eon. And there's been many, many universes and eons, and this one is impermanent. So this koan is, when this universe is destroyed in this raging firestorm, at the end of the eon. Is this destroyed or not? And in Zen, this means like the Buddha, reality of the eternal true self, I would say. And that's the question. And when this, in the Zen koan, when one teacher asks, he said, yes, it's destroyed. It goes along with the universe. And then the monk asks another teacher the same question, and that teacher says, no, it's not destroyed. So there's not an easy answer. You could look at it from both points of view.
I'm not even thinking in apocalyptic terms.
But that's...
I'm thinking about the crisis we face right now.
It's kind of apocalyptic.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
On a small scale.
Yeah.
Talking Earth versus universe.
Yeah, but either way, the universe just drives the point home even further. It's like, let's talk. Like the biggest apocalypse we could possibly imagine.
Right.
Is not only is there no Earth, but there's not even a universe. There won't be a sun, yeah. There won't be any of this. But is this destroyed or not? It's a great meditation. We're not going to answer the question because we can't answer this question. But it's a great meditation to really contemplate what is this and how could somebody be so bold as to imply that actually this is not destroyed? The sutra is kind of implying that if something's eternal, that means it's indestructible. It's not destroyed. And we might say, yeah, it's not destroyed until the end of the kalpa when the universe is destroyed. And at that point, then isn't it destroyed? But I think we're talking about, my understanding here is we're talking about that which is by nature indestructible because it's not a compounded phenomena. It's not something that could be destroyed. But the way the teachings are presented are definitely for humans on planet Earth. The way this comes to us in words are for us. So I've been contemplating this very question even the last few days, really thinking about what about the Dharma when humans are gone, which might be pretty soon. Like, is it? I think a deeper question. For me, a koan, really, for me, the really living koan is it okay? Do I trust that actually the deepest Dharma that's not in these sutras, because these sutras are going to be long gone when there's no humans, and the digital hard drives are going to be long gone, and the next species that learns to read, the hard drives will be long disintegrated. So it's not going to be Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching, but is what Shakyamuni's pointing to, is that, can that be destroyed? When there's no humans, I think it can't be destroyed. When there's no life at all, as we know it, well, I think as we know it is an important thing to consider. On this planet, more and more as I practice, I feel like it's not, the view gets bigger and bigger, so I don't think it's limited to this particular planet. That's too biased. We say like anthropocentrism, we might say planetocentrism. We're so biased towards this planet. I mean, of course, from a conventional view, let's try everything we can to take care of this. But at the same time, remember that that it may be much vaster than maybe the question is, can we trust what doesn't even rely on our solar system or planet? Right? That's a big request, right? Maybe this sutra will help us. And maybe if we can rely on that, maybe it will help us. Maybe it sounds ironic, but maybe that understanding will help us take care of the details on this planet more fully. Sounds a little bit ironic, right? But I think so, because we can do it more freely. So, okay. Well, let's just finish this paragraph. Not self is bondage, samsara. The self is the Tathagata. So this is the Buddha now kind of playing with these ideas. We might say, what is not self is samsara. What is not self is all conditioned things. And the true self is the Tathagata, the Buddha. Impermanence is the Shravakas and Prajnaka Buddhas, small vehicle practitioners. We might say, what is impermanent is those Shravakas and Prajnaka Buddhas. They're not, because they're not, we're not talking about Buddha nature as permanent. We're talking about particular practitioners, and they die. But the eternal is the Tathagata's reality body, the Dharmakaya. What is discontent is all heretics. This is where Chirtika, so you could say the philosophers in India outside of the Buddha's teaching. And maybe it's implying that they are not ultimately content because they don't understand this. But bliss is nirvana. The impure is all compounded things. The pure is the true dharma of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. This is called non-distortion or non-inversion. By not being inverted in one's view, one will know both the letter and the meaning of the teaching. If one desires to be free from the four distorted views, this term, viparita drishti, one should know the eternal, the blissful, the self, and the pure in this manner. So this is where he's really now introducing eternal, blissful, self, and pure, which in Japanese is Jōraku ga jō, is a line from the Enmeijuku Kanagyo, which I think comes from the sutra. This is the main source of that teaching. It's going to get brought up, not just in this line, but all throughout the sutra. Jōraku ga jō, as the qualities of Buddha nature, or the true self. When we chant the Enmeijuku Kanagyo, we can remember. I think it's kind of, I think of it these days as pointing towards, like, we do it in well-being ceremonies, but like, we're sending healing energy towards this person, but let us remember and let them remember the eternal, blissful, true self of purity as we chant that. So it's a lot to consider. May our intention equally extend to every being and place so that all may realize Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.